When we returned to the building with an empty crate, however, pandemonium broke out. As soon as they saw that the fruits were gone, 25 apes burst out, hooting and hollering in a most festive mood, slapping one another's backs. I have never seen animals so excited about absent food. They must have inferred that grapefruits cannot vanish, hence must have remained on the island onto which the colony would soon be released. This kind of reasoning does not fall into any simple category of trial and error learning, especially since it was the first time we followed this procedure. The grapefruit experiment was a one-time event to study responses to cached food. One of the first tests of inferential reasoning was conducted by American psychologists David and Anne Premack, who presented Sadie, a chimpanzee, with two boxes. They placed an apple in one and a banana in the other. After a few minutes of distraction, Sadie saw one of the experimenters munching on either an apple or a banana. This experimenter then left, and Sadie was released to inspect the boxes. She faced an interesting dilemma, since she had not seen how the experimenter had gotten his fruit. Invariably, Sadie would go to the box with the fruit that the experimenter had not eaten. The Premacks ruled out gradual learning, because Sadie made this choice on the very first trial, as well as all subsequent ones. She seemed to have reached two conclusions. First, that the eating experimenter had removed his fruit from one of the two boxes, even if she had not actually seen him do so, and second, that this meant that the other box must still hold the other fruit. The Premacks note that most animals don't make any such assumptions. They just see an experimenter consume fruit. That's all. Chimpanzees, in contrast, try to figure out the order of events, looking for logic, filling in the blanks. Years later, the Spanish primatologist Josep Coll presented apes with two covered cups. They had learned that only one would be baited with grapes. If Coll removed the tops and let them look inside the cups, the apes chose the one with grapes. Next, he kept the cups covered and shook first one, then the other. Only the cup with grapes made noise, which was the one they preferred. This was not too surprising. But making things harder, Coll would sometimes shake only the empty cup, which made no noise. In this case, the apes would still pick the other one, thus operating on the basis of exclusion. From the absence of sound, they guessed where the grapes must be. Perhaps we are not impressed by this either, as we take such inferences for granted, but it is not all that obvious. Dogs, for example, flunk this task. Apes are special in that they seek logical connections based on how they believe the world works. Here it gets interesting, because aren't we supposed to go for the simplest possible explanation? If large-brained animals, such as apes, try to get at the logic behind events, could this be the simplest level at which they operate? It reminds me of Morgan's provision to his canon, according to which we are allowed more complex premises in the case of more intelligent species. We most certainly apply this rule to ourselves. We always try to figure things out, applying our reasoning powers to everything around us. We go so far as to invent causes if we can't find any, leading to weird superstitions and supernatural beliefs, such as sports fans wearing the same T-shirt over and over for luck, and disasters being blamed on the hand of God. We are so logic-driven that we can't stand the absence of it. Evidently, the word simple is not as simple as it sounds. It means different things in relation to different species, which complicates the eternal battle between skeptics and cognitivists. In addition, we often get tangled up in semantics that aren't worth the heat they generate. One scientist will argue that monkeys understand the danger posed by leopards, whereas another will say that monkeys have merely learned from experience that leopards sometimes kill members of their species. Both statements are really not that different, even though the first uses the language of understanding and the second of learning. With the decline of behaviorism, debates on these issues have fortunately grown less fiery. By attributing all behavior under the sun to a single learning mechanism, behaviorism set up its own downfall. Its dogmatic overreach made it more like a religion than a scientific approach. Ethologists loved to slam it, saying that instead of domesticating white rats in order to make them suitable to a particular testing paradigm, behaviorists should have done the opposite. They should have invented paradigms that fit real animals. The counterpunch came in 1953, when Daniel Lehrman, an American comparative psychologist, sharply attacked ethology. Lehrman objected to simplistic definitions of innate, saying that even species-typical behavior develops from a history of interaction with the environment. Since nothing is purely inborn, the term instinct is in fact misleading and should be avoided. Ethologists were stung and dismayed by his unexpected critique. But once they got over their adrenaline attack, Tinbergen's words, they discovered that Lehrman hardly fit the behaviorist boogeyman stereotype. He was an enthusiastic birdwatcher, for example, who knew his animals. This impressed the ethologists, and Behrens recalled that while meeting the enemy in person, they managed to resolve most misunderstandings, found common ground, and became very good friends. Once Tinbergen became acquainted with Danny, as they now knew Lehrman, he went so far as to call him more of a zoologist than a psychologist, which the latter took as a compliment. Their bonding over birds went way beyond the way John F. Kennedy and Nikita Khrushchev bonded over Pushinka, a little dog that the Soviet leader sent to the White House. Despite this gesture, the Cold War continued unabated. In contrast, Lehrman's harsh critique and the subsequent meeting of minds between comparative psychologists and ethologists set in motion a process of mutual respect and understanding. Tinbergen, in particular, acknowledged Lehrman's influence on his later thinking. Apparently, they had needed a big spat to start a rapprochement, which was hastened by ongoing criticism within each camp of its own tenets. Within ethology, the younger generation grumbled about the rigid Lorentzian drive and instinct concepts, whereas comparative psychology had an even longer tradition of challenges to its own dominant paradigm. Cognitive approaches had been tried off and on even as early as the 1930s. But ironically, the biggest blow to behaviorism came from within. It all started with a simple learning experiment conducted on rats. Anyone who has tried to punish a dog or cat for problematic behavior knows that it is best to do so quickly, while the offense is still visible or at least fresh in the animal's mind. If you wait too long, your pet doesn't connect your scolding with the stolen meat or the droppings behind the couch. Since short intervals between behavior and consequence have always been regarded as essential, no one was prepared when in 1955, the American psychologist John Garcia claimed he had found a case that broke all the rules. Rats learned to refuse poisoned foods after just a single bad experience, even if the resulting nausea takes hours to set in. Moreover, the negative outcome had to be nausea. Electric shock didn't have the same effect. Since toxic nutrition works slowly and makes you sick, none of this was particularly surprising from a biological standpoint. Avoiding bad food seems a highly adaptive mechanism. For standard learning theory, however, these findings came like a bolt out of the blue, due to the assumption that time intervals should be short, while the kind of punishment is irrelevant. The findings were in fact devastating, and Garcia's conclusions were so unwelcome that he had trouble getting them published. One imaginative reviewer contended that his data were less likely than finding bird shit in a cuckoo clock. The Garcia effect is now well established, though. In our own lives, we remember food that had poisoned us so well that we gag at the mere thought of it, or never set foot in a certain restaurant again. For readers who wonder about the fierce resistance to Garcia's discovery, despite the fact that most of us have first-hand experience with the power of nausea, it is good to realize that human behavior was, and still is, often seen as the product of reflection, such as an analysis of cause and effect, whereas animal behavior was supposedly free of such processes. Scientists were not ready to equate the two. Human reflection is chronically overrated, though, and we now suspect that our own reaction to food poisoning is in fact similar to that of rats. Garcia's findings forced comparative psychology to admit that evolution pushes cognition around, adapting it to the organism's needs. This became known as biologically prepared learning. Each organism is driven to learn those things it needs to know in order to survive. This realization obviously helped the rapprochement with ethology. Moreover, the geographic distance between both schools fell away. Once comparative psychology took hold in Europe, which is how I briefly ended up in a behaviorist lab, and ethology was being taught in North American zoology departments, students on both sides of the Atlantic could absorb the entire range of views and begin to integrate them. The synthesis between the two approaches did not take place just at international meetings or in the literature, therefore, but also in the classrooms. We entered a period of crossover scholars, which I'll illustrate with just two examples. The first is the American psychologist Sarah Shettleworth, who for most of her career taught at the University of Toronto, and who has been influential through her textbooks on animal cognition. She started out in the behaviorist corner, but ended up advocating a biological approach to cognition that is sensitive to the ecological needs of each species. She remains as cautious in her interpretations of cognition as one would expect from someone of her background, yet her work gained a clear ethological flavor, which she attributes to certain professors when she was a student, as well as involvement with her husband's fieldwork on sea turtles. In an interview about her career, Shettleworth explicitly mentions Garcia's work as a turning point that opened the eyes of her field to the evolutionary forces shaping learning and cognition. At the other end of the scale is one of my heroes, Hans Kummer, a Swiss primatologist and ethologist. As a student, I avidly devoured every paper he wrote, mostly his field studies on hamadryas baboons in Ethiopia. Kummer did not just observe social behavior and relate it to ethology. He always puzzled about the cognition behind it and conducted field experiments on temporarily captured baboons. He later moved to captive work on long-tailed macaques at the University of Zurich. Kummer felt that the only way to test cognitive theories was by means of controlled experiments. Observation alone was not going to cut it, so primatologists should become more like comparative psychologists if they ever wish to unravel the puzzle of cognition. I went through a similar transition from observation to experimentation and was greatly inspired by Kummer's macaque lab when I set up my own lab for capuchin monkeys. The trick is to house the animals socially. Hence, build large indoor and outdoor areas where the monkeys can spend most of the day playing, grooming, fighting, catching insects, and so on. We trained them to enter a test chamber where they could work on a touch screen or a social task before we'd return them to the group. This arrangement had two advantages over traditional labs, which keep monkeys rather like Skinner's pigeons in single cages. First of all, there was the quality of life issue. It is my personal feeling that if we are going to keep highly social animals in captivity, the very least we can do for them is to permit them a group life. This is the best and most ethical way to enrich their lives and make them thrive. Second, it makes no sense to test monkeys on social skills without giving them a chance to express these skills in daily life. They need to be completely familiar with one another for us to investigate how they share food, cooperate, or judge one another's situation. Kummer understood all this, having started out, like myself, as a primate watcher. In my opinion, anyone who intends to conduct experiments on animal cognition should first spend a couple thousand hours observing the spontaneous behavior of the species in question. Otherwise, we get experiments uninformed by natural behavior, which is precisely the approach we should be leaving behind. Today's evolutionary cognition is a blend of both schools, taking the best parts of each. It applies the controlled experimental methodology developed by comparative psychology, combined with the blind testing that worked so well with Clever Hans, while adopting the rich evolutionary framework and observation techniques of ethology. For many young scientists, it is now immaterial whether we call them comparative psychologists or ethologists, since they integrate concepts and techniques from both. On top of this comes a third major influence, at least for work in the field. The impact of Japanese primatology is not always recognized in the West, which is why I have called it a silent invasion, but we routinely name individual animals and track their social careers across multiple generations. This allows us to understand the kinship ties and friendships at the core of group life. Begun by Imanishi right after World War II, this method has become standard in work on long-lived animals, from dolphins to elephants and primates. Unbelievably, there was a time when Western professors warned their students away from the Japanese school, because naming animals was considered too humanizing. There was, of course, also the language barrier, which made it hard for Japanese scientists to get heard. Junichiro Itani, Imanishi's foremost student, was met with disbelief when he toured American universities in 1958 because no one believed that he and his colleagues were able to tell 100 or more monkeys apart. Monkeys look so much alike that Itani obviously was making things up. He once told me that he was mocked to his face and had no one to defend him except the great American primatological pioneer, Ray Carpenter, who did see the value of this approach. Nowadays, of course, we know that recognizing a large number of monkeys is possible, and we all do it. Not unlike Lawrence's emphasis on knowing the whole animal, Imanishi urged us to empathize with the species under study. "We need to get under its skin," he said. Or as we would nowadays put it, try to enter its umwelt. This old theme in the study of animal behavior is quite different from the misguided notion of critical distance, which has given us excessive worries about anthropomorphism. The eventual international embrace of the Japanese approach illustrates something else that we learned from the tale of two schools, ethology and comparative psychology, which is that the initial animosity between divergent approaches can be overcome if we realize that each has something to offer that the other lacks. We may weave them together into a new whole that is stronger than the sum of its parts. The fusing of complementary strands is what makes evolutionary cognition the promising approach it is today. But sadly, it took a century of misunderstanding and colliding egos before we got there. Beewolves. Tinbergen was in tears when last I saw him. It was 1973, the year in which he, Lawrence, and von Frisch were honored with Nobel Prizes. He had come to Amsterdam to receive a different medal and give a lecture. Speaking in Dutch, his voice quavering with emotion, he asked what we had done to his country. The magnificent little spot in the dunes where he had studied gulls and terns was no more. Decades earlier, while emigrating aboard a boat to England, he had pointed at the site, the eternal self-rolled cigarette in his hand, predicting that it will all go irrevocably. Years later, the place was swallowed up by the expansion of Rotterdam Harbor, then the busiest in the world. Tinbergen's lecture reminded me of all the great things he had done, which included animal cognition, even though he never used the term. He had worked on how digger wasps find their nest after a trip away. Also known as bee wolves, these wasps capture and paralyze a honeybee, drag it to their nest in the sand, a long burrow, and leave it as a meal for their larvae. Before they go out to hunt for a bee, they make a brief orientation flight to memorize the location of their inconspicuous burrow. Tinbergen put objects around the nest, such as a circle of pine cones, to see what information they used to find it back. He was able to trick the wasps, making them search at the wrong location by moving his pine cones around. His study addressed problem-solving tied to a species' natural history, precisely the topic of evolutionary cognition. The wasps proved very good at this particular task. Brainier animals have less restricted cognition and often find solutions to novel or unusual problems. The ending of my grapefruit story with the chimpanzees offers a nice demonstration. After releasing the apes onto the island, a number of them passed over the site where we had hidden the fruits under the sand. Only a few small yellow patches were visible. Dandy, a young adult male, hardly slowed down when he ran over the place. Later in the afternoon, however, when all the apes were dozing off in the sun, he made a beeline for the spot. Without hesitation, he dug up the fruits and devoured them at his leisure, which he would never have been able to do had he stopped right when he saw them. He would have lost them to dominant group mates. Here we see the entire spectrum of animal cognition, from the specialized navigation of a predatory wasp to the generalized cognition of apes, which allows them to handle a great variety of problems, including novel ones. What struck me most is that Dandy, at his first passing, didn't linger for a second. He must have made an instant calculation that deception was going to be his best bet. Chapter 3. Cognitive Ripples. Eureka. The sunny, breezy Canary Islands are about the last place in the world where one would expect a cognitive revolution. Yet this is where it all began. In 1913, the German psychologist Wolfgang Kühler came to Tenerife, off the coast of Africa, to head the Anthropoid Research Station, where he remained until after World War I. Even though rumor has it that his job was to spy on passing military vessels, Kühler devoted most of his attention to a small colony of chimpanzees. Having eluded indoctrination in the learning theories of his day, Kühler was refreshingly open-minded about animal cognition. Instead of trying to control his animals to seek specific outcomes, he had a wait-and-see attitude. He presented them with simple challenges to find out how they'd meet them. For his most talented chimpanzee, Sultan, he would put a banana out of reach on the ground and offer him sticks that were too short to reach the fruit. Or he would hang a banana high up in the air and spread large wooden boxes around, none of which was tall enough for the purpose. Sultan would first jump or throw things at the banana, or drag humans by the hand toward it in the hope that they'd help him out, or at least be willing to serve as a footstool. If this failed, he would sit around for a while without doing anything, until he might hit at a sudden solution. He would jump up to put one bamboo stick inside another, making a longer stick. Or he would stack boxes on top of one another so as to build a tower that allowed him to reach the banana. Kühler described this moment as the aha experience, as if a light bulb had been switched on. Not unlike the story of Archimedes, who jumped out of his bath in which he had discovered how to measure the volume of submerged objects, after which he ran naked through the streets of Syracuse, shouting, "Eureka!" According to Kühler, a sudden insight explained how Sultan put together what he knew about bananas, boxes, and sticks to produce a brand new action sequence that would take care of his problem. The scientist ruled out imitation and trial-and-error learning, since Sultan had had no previous experience with these solutions, nor ever been rewarded for them. The outcome was unwaveringly purposeful action, in which the ape kept trying to reach his goal despite the numerous stacking errors resulting in the collapse of his towers. A female, Granda, was an even more undeterred and patient architect, who once built a wobbly tower of 4 boxes. Kuhler remarked that once a solution was discovered, the apes found it easier to solve similar problems, as if they had learned something about the causal connections. He described his experiments in admirable detail in The Mentality of Apes in 1925, which was at first ignored and then disparaged, but that now stands as a classic in evolutionary cognition. The insightful solutions of Sultan and other apes hint at the kind of mental activity that we refer to as thinking, even though its precise nature was and still is barely understood. A few years later, the American primate expert Robert Yerkes described similar solutions. "Frequently, I have seen a young chimpanzee, after trying in vain to get its reward by one method, sit down and re-examine the situation, as though taking stock of its former efforts and trying to decide what to do next. More startling by far than the quick passage from one method to another, the definiteness of acts or the pauses between efforts, is the sudden solution of problems. Frequently, although not in all individuals or in all problems, correct and adequate solution is achieved without warning and almost instantly." Yerkes went on to note that those who only know animals that are good at trial and error learning can scarcely be expected to believe his descriptions. He thus anticipated the inevitable pushback to these revolutionary ideas. Unsurprisingly, it arrived in the form of trained pigeons shoving little boxes around in a dollhouse so that they could stand on top of them to reach a tiny plastic banana associated with grain rewards. How entertaining! At the same time, Kuhler's interpretations were criticized as anthropomorphic. But I heard an amusing antidote to these accusations from an American primatologist brave enough to enter the Skinnerian lion's den in the 1970s, where he debated tool-using apes. Without offering specifics, Emil Menzel told me that an eminent East Coast professor once invited him to speak. This professor looked down on primate research and was openly hostile to cognitive interpretations, two orientations that often go together. Perhaps he invited young Menzel to make fun of him, not realizing that the tables might be turned. Menzel treated his audience to spectacular footage of his chimpanzees putting a long pole against their enclosure's high wall. While some individuals held the pole steady, others scaled it to reach temporary freedom. It was a complex operation, since the apes needed to avoid coils of electrified wire while recruiting one another's assistance at critical moments through hand gestures. Menzel, who'd filmed all this himself, decided to run his footage without mentioning intelligence. It was going to be as neutral as possible. His narration was purely descriptive. "You now see Rock grab the pole while glancing at the others," or, "Here a chimpanzee swings over the wall." After his lecture, the professor jumped up to accuse Menzel of being unscientific and anthropomorphic, of attributing plans and intentions to animals that obviously had neither. To a roar of approval, Menzel countered that he had not attributed anything. If this professor had seen plans and intentions, he must have seen them with his own eyes, because Menzel himself had refrained from suggesting any such things. Interviewing Menzel at my home, he lived nearby, a few years before his death, I took the opportunity to ask him about Kuhler. Widely recognized as a great expert on great apes himself, Menzel said it had taken him years working with chimps to fully appreciate this pioneer's genius. Like Kuhler, Menzel believed in watching over and over and thinking through what his observations might mean, even if he'd seen a certain behavior only once. He protested against labeling a single observation an anecdote, adding with a mischievous smile, "My definition of an anecdote is someone else's observation. If you have seen something yourself and followed the entire dynamic, there usually is no doubt in your mind of what to make of it. But others may be skeptical and need convincing." Here, I cannot resist telling an anecdote of my own. And I do not mean the great escape at Bugert's zoo, where the chimpanzee colony did exactly what Menzel had documented. After 25 apes raided the zoo's restaurant, we found a tree trunk, far too heavy for a single ape to carry, propped against the inside wall of their enclosure. Nope, I mean an insightful solution to a social problem, a sort of social tool use. That is my specialty. Two female chimps were sitting in the sun, with their children rolling around in the sand in front of them. When the play turned into a screaming, hair-pulling fight, neither mother knew what to do, because if one of them tried to break up the fight, it was guaranteed that the other would protect her offspring, since mothers are never impartial. It is not unusual for a juvenile quarrel to escalate into an adult fight. Both mothers nervously monitored each other as well as the fight. Noticing the alpha female, Mama, asleep nearby, one of them went over to poke her in the ribs. As the old matriarch got up, the mother pointed at the fight by swinging an arm in its direction. Mama needed only one glance to grasp what was going on, and took a step forward with a threatening grunt. Her authority was such that this shut up the youngsters. The mother had found a quick and efficient solution to her problem, relying on the mutual understanding typical of chimpanzees. Similar understanding can be seen in their altruism, such as when younger females collect water in their mouths for an aging female who can barely walk anymore, spitting it into her open mouth so that she doesn't have to walk all the way to the spigot. The British primatologist Jane Goodall described how Madame B., a wild chimpanzee, had become too old and weak to climb into fruiting trees. She would patiently wait at the bottom for her daughter to carry down fruits, upon which the two of them would contentedly munch together. In such cases, too, apes grasp a problem and come up with a fresh solution. But the striking part here is that they perceive another ape's problem. Since these social perceptions have attracted much research, we'll delve into them later on. But let me clarify one general point about problem-solving. Although Kuhler stressed that trial-and-error learning could not explain his observations, it was not as if learning played no role at all. In fact, his apes committed tons of stupidities, as Kuhler called them, that showed that solutions were rarely perfectly formed in their minds and required quite a bit of tweaking. His apes had undoubtedly learned the affordances of various items. This term from cognitive psychology refers to how objects can be used, such as the handle on a teacup, which affords holding, or the steps on a ladder, which afford climbing. Sultan must have known the affordances of sticks and boxes before he hit on his solutions. Similarly, the female chimp who activated Mama had no doubt witnessed the latter's effectiveness as an arbitrator. Insightful solutions invariably rest on prior information. What is special about apes is their capacity to flexibly weave such pre-existing knowledge into new patterns, never tried before, that work to their advantage. I have speculated the same about their political strategies, such as the way chimps will isolate a rival from his supporters, or encourage a truce by dragging reluctant former combatants toward each other. In all such cases, we see apes finding insightful solutions to everyday problems. They are so good at it that even the staunchest skeptic, as Menzel discovered, finds it impossible to watch them without being struck by their obvious intentionality and intelligence. Wasp mugs. There was a time when scientists thought behavior derived from either learning or biology. Human behavior was on the learning side, animal behavior was on the biology side, and there was little in between. Never mind the false dichotomy. In all species, behavior is a product of both, but increasingly a third explanation had to be added. Cognition. Cognition relates to the kind of information an organism gathers and how it processes and applies this information. Clark's nutcrackers remember where they have stored thousands of nuts, bee wolves make an orientation flight before leaving their burrow, and chimpanzees nonchalantly learn the affordances of play objects. Without any reward or punishment, animals accumulate knowledge that will come in handy in the future, from finding nuts in the spring to returning to one's burrow to reaching a banana. The role of learning is obvious, but what is special about cognition is that it puts learning in its proper place. Learning is a mere tool. It allows animals to collect information in a world that, like the Internet, contains a staggering amount of it. It is easy to drown in the information swamp. An organism's cognition narrows down the information flow and makes it learn those specific contingencies that it needs to know given its natural history. Many animals have cognitive achievements in common. The more scientists discover, the more ripple effects we notice. Capacities that were once thought to be uniquely human, or at least uniquely hominoid, the tiny primate family of humans plus apes, often turns out to be widespread. Traditionally, apes have been the first to inspire discoveries, thanks to their manifest intellect. After the apes break down the dam between humans and the rest of the animal kingdom, the floodgates often open to include species after species. Cognitive ripples spread from apes to monkeys to dolphins, elephants, and dogs, followed by birds, reptiles, fish, and sometimes invertebrates. This historical progression is not to be confused with a scale with hominoids on top. I rather view it as an ever-expanding pool of possibilities in which the cognition of, say, the octopus may be no less astonishing than that of any given mammal or bird. Consider face recognition, which was initially viewed as uniquely human. Now apes and monkeys have joined the countenance elite. Every year when I visit the Burkert's Zoo in Arnhem, a few chimps still remember me from more than 3 decades before. They pick out my face from the crowd, greeting me with excited hooting. Not only do primates recognize faces, but faces are special to them. Like humans, they show an inversion effect. They have trouble recognizing faces that are turned upside down. This effect is specific for faces. How an image is oriented hardly matters for the recognition of other objects, such as plants, birds, or houses. When we tested capuchin monkeys using touch screens, we noticed that they freely tapped all sorts of images, but they freaked out at the first face that appeared. They clutched themselves and whined, reluctant to touch the picture. Did they treat it with more respect because putting a hand on a face violates a social taboo? Once they got over their hesitation, we showed them portraits of group mates and unknown monkeys. All these portraits look alike to naive humans since they concern the same species, but our monkeys had no trouble telling them apart, indicating with a little tap on the screen which ones they knew and which ones they didn't. We humans take this ability for granted, but the monkeys had to link a two-dimensional pattern of pixels to a live individual in the real world, which they did. Face recognition, science concluded, is a specialized cognitive skill of primates. But no sooner had it done so than the first cognitive ripples arrived. Face recognition has been found in crows, sheep, even wasps. It is unclear what faces mean to crows. In their natural lives, they have so many other ways of recognizing one another by calls, flight patterns, size, and so on, that faces may not be relevant, but crows have incredibly sharp eyes, so they likely notice that humans are easiest recognized by their faces. Lawrence reported harassment of certain people by crows, and was so convinced of their ability to hold a grudge that he disguised himself with a costume whenever he captured and banded his jackdaws. Both jackdaws and crows are corvids, a brainy bird family that also includes jays, magpies, and ravens. Wildlife biologist John Marsluff at the University of Washington in Seattle has captured so many crows that these birds take his name in vain whenever he walks around, scolding and dive-bombing him. doing justice to the murder label used for a whole bunch of them. We don't know how they pick us out of the 40,000 folks scurrying like two-legged ants over well-worn trails, but single us out they do, and nearby crows flee while uttering a call that sounds to us like vocal disgust. In contrast, they calmly walk among our students and colleagues who have never captured, measured, banded, or otherwise humiliated them. Marzlov set out to test this recognition with rubber face masks like those we put on at Halloween. After all, crows may recognize certain people by their bodies, hair, or clothes, but with masks you can move the human face around from one body to the next, isolating its specific role. His Angry Birds experiment involved capturing crows while wearing a particular mask, then have co-workers walk around with either this mask or a neutral one. Funny enough, the neutral mask was Vice President Dick Cheney's face, which elicited more negative reactions from the students on campus than from the crows. Not only did birds that had never been captured recognize the predator mask, but years later they still harassed its wearers. They must have picked up on the hateful response of their fellows, resulting in massive distrust of specific humans. As Marzlov explains, it would be a rare hawk that would be nice to a crow. But with humans, you have to classify us as individuals. Clearly, they're able to do that. While corvids always impress us, sheep seem to go a step further in that they remember one another's faces. British scientists, led by Keith Kendrick, taught sheep the difference between 25 pairs of their own species' faces by rewarding a choice for one face and not for the other. To us, all these faces look eerily alike. But the sheep learned and retained the 25 differences for up to 2 years. In doing so, they used the same brain regions and neural circuits as humans, with some neurons responding specifically to faces and not to other stimuli. These special neurons were activated if the sheep saw pictures of companions that they remembered. They actually called out to these pictures as if the individuals were present. Publishing their study under the subtitle, "Sheep Are Not So Stupid After All," a title to which I object since I don't believe in stupid animals, the investigators put the face recognition ability of sheep on a par with that of primates, and speculated that a flock, which to us looks like an anonymous mass, is in fact quite differentiated. This also means that mixing flocks, as is sometimes done, may cause more distress than we realize. Having made primate chauvinists look sheepish, science piled it on with wasps. The northern paper wasp, common in the American Midwest, has a highly structured society with a hierarchy among its founding queens who were dominant over all workers. Given the intense competition, each wasp needs to know her place. The alpha queen lays most eggs, followed by the beta queen, and so on. Members of the small colony are aggressive to outsiders as well as to females whose facial markings have been altered by experimenters. They recognize one another by strikingly different patterns of yellow and black on every female's face. The American scientists Michael Sheehan and Elizabeth Tibbetts tested individual recognition and found it to be as specialized as that of primates and sheep. The wasps distinguish their own species' mugs far better than other visual stimuli, and they also outperform a closely related wasp that lives in colonies founded by a single queen. These wasps hardly have a hierarchy and have far more homogeneous faces. They don't need individual recognition. If face recognition has evolved in such disparate pockets of the animal kingdom, one wonders how these capacities connect. Wasps do not have the big brains of primates and sheep. They have minuscule sets of neural ganglia, hence they must be doing it in a different manner. Biologists never tire of stressing the distinction between mechanism and function. It is very common for animals to achieve the same end, function, by different means, mechanism. Yet with respect to cognition, This distinction is sometimes forgotten when the mental achievements of large-brained animals are questioned by pointing at lower animals doing something similar. Skeptics delight in asking, if wasps can do it, what's the big deal? This race to the bottom has given us trained pigeons hopping onto little boxes to disparage Kuhler's experiments on apes, and the holding up of intelligence outside the primate order to cast doubt on mental continuity between humans and other hominoids. The underlying thought is that of a linear cognitive scale, and the argument that since we rarely assume complex cognition in lower animals, there is no reason to do so in higher ones, as if there were only one way to achieve a given outcome. This is not the case. Nature abounds with illustrations to the contrary. One that I know firsthand is a pair-bonding Amazonian cichlid, the discus fish, that has achieved the equivalent of mammalian nursing. Once the fry have absorbed the egg yolk, they gather along the flanks of mom and dad to nibble mucus off their bodies. The breeding pair secretes extra mucus for this purpose. The young enjoy both nutrition and protection for about a month, until they are weaned by parents who now turn away each time they approach. No one would use these fish to make a point about the complexity or simplicity of mammalian nursing, for the obvious reason that the mechanisms are radically different. All that they share is the function of feeding and raising the young. Mechanism and function are the eternal yin and yang of biology. They interact and intertwine, yet there is no greater sin than confusing the two. To understand how evolution works its magic across the evolutionary tree, we often invoke the twin concepts of homology and analogy. Homology refers to shared traits derived from a common ancestor. Thus, the human hand is homologous with the wing of a bat, since both derive from an ancestral forelimb and carry the exact same number of bones to prove it. Analogies, on the other hand, arise when distant animals independently evolve in the same direction, known as convergent evolution. The parental care of the discus fish is analogous to mammalian nursing, but certainly not homologous, since fish and mammals do not share an ancestor that did the same. Another example is how dolphins, ichthyosaurs, extinct marine reptiles, and fish all have strikingly similar shapes owing to an environment in which a streamlined body with fins serves speed and maneuverability. Since dolphins, ichthyosaurs, and fish did not share an aquatic ancestor, their shapes are analogous. We can apply the same line of thought to behavior. The sensitivity to faces in wasps and primates came about independently, as a striking analogy, based on the need to recognize individual groupmates. Convergent evolution is incredibly powerful. It has equipped both bats and whales with echolocation, both insects and birds with wings, and both primates and opossums with opposable thumbs. It has also produced spectacularly similar species in distant geographic regions, such as the armored bodies of armadillos and pangolins, the prickly defense of hedgehogs and porcupines, and the predatory weaponry of the Tasmanian tiger and the coyote. There is even a primate, the II of Madagascar, that looks like E.T., with an extremely elongated middle finger, to tap for hollow spots and extract grubs from wood. A trait that it shares with a small marsupial, the long-fingered triarch of New Guinea. These species are genetically miles apart, yet they have evolved the same functional solution. We should not be surprised, therefore, to find similar cognitive and behavioral traits in species that are eons and continents apart. Cognitive rippling is common precisely because it isn't bound by the evolutionary tree. The same capacity may pop up almost anywhere it is needed. Instead of taking this as an argument against cognitive evolution, as some have done, it perfectly fits the way evolution works through either common descent or adaptation to similar circumstances. A prime example of convergent evolution is the use of tools. Redefining Man. As soon as an ape sees something attractive yet out of reach, he starts to cast about for a bodily extension. An apple floats in the moat around the zoo island. The ape takes one glance at the fruit before racing around in search of a suitable stick or a few stones that he can throw behind it so that it will float toward him. He distances himself from his goal in order to reach it. An illogical thing to do, while carrying a search image of what tool might work best. He is in a hurry because if he doesn't return fast enough, someone else will beat him to the prize. If, on the other hand, his goal is to eat fresh green leaves from a tree, the required tool is quite different, something sturdy to climb on. He may work for half an hour to drag and roll a heavy, loose tree stump in the direction of the one tree on the island that has a low side branch. The whole reason he needs a tool is to get across the electric wire around the tree. Before making the actual attempt, he has figured out that the low branch will come in handy. I have even seen apes check the hot wires with the hair on the back of their wrist, hand bent inward, barely touching it, but enough to know if the power is on. If it is off, obviously no tool will be needed, and the foliage is fair game. Apes do not just search for tools for specific occasions. They actually fabricate them. When the British anthropologist Kenneth Oakley, in 1957, wrote Man the Toolmaker, which claimed that only humans make tools, he was well aware of Cooler's observations of Sultan fitting sticks together. But Oakley refused to count this as tool manufacture, since it was done in reaction to a given situation, rather than in anticipation of an imagined future. Even today, some scholars dismiss ape tools by stressing how human technology is embedded in social roles, symbols, production, and education. A chimpanzee cracking nuts with a rock doesn't qualify. Nor, I suspect, does a farmer picking his teeth with a twig. One philosopher even felt that since chimpanzees don't need their so-called tools, it remains a feeble comparison. I feel like recalling my Know Thy Animal rule here, according to which we can safely dismiss a philosopher who thinks that wild chimpanzees sit there pounding and pounding hard nuts with rocks, an average of 33 blows per consumed kernel for generation after generation, for no good reason at all. During peak season, chimpanzees at some field sites spend close to 20% of their waking hours fishing with twigs for termites or cracking nuts between rocks. It is estimated that they gain 9 times as many kilocalories of energy from this activity as they put into it. Moreover, the Japanese primatologist Gen Yamakoshi found that nuts serve as fallback foods when the ape's main nutrition, seasonal fruits, is scarce. Another fallback is palm pith, which is obtained through pestle pounding. High up in a tree, a chimpanzee stands bipedally at the edge of the tree crown, pounding the top with a leaf stalk, thus creating a deep hole from which fiber and sap can be collected. In other words, the survival of chimpanzees is quite dependent on tools. Ben Beck gave us the best-known definition of tool use, of which the short version goes as follows. The external deployment of an unattached environmental object to alter more efficiently the form, position, or condition of another object. Though imperfect, this definition has served the field of animal behavior for decades. Tool manufacture can then be defined as the active modification of an unattached object to make it more effective in relation to one's goal. Note that intentionality matters a great deal. Tools are brought in from a distance and modified with a goal in mind, which is the reason traditional learning scenarios which revolve around accidentally discovered benefits have such trouble explaining this behavior. If you see a chimpanzee strip the side branches off a twig to make it right for ant fishing, or collect a fistful of fresh leaves and chew them into a sponge-like clump to absorb water from a tree hole, it is hard to miss the purposefulness. By making suitable tools out of raw material, chimpanzees are exhibiting the very behavior that once defined Homo faber, man the creator. This is why the British paleontologist Lewis Leakey, when he first heard about such behavior from Goodall, wrote her back, "I feel that scientists holding to this definition are faced with three choices. They must accept chimpanzees as man, they must redefine man, or they must redefine tools." After the many observations of chimpanzee tool use in captivity, seeing tool use in the wild by the same species did perhaps not come as a surprise. Yet its discovery was crucial, since it could not be explained away by human influence. Moreover, wild chimps not only use and make tools, but they learn from one another, which allows them to refine their tools over generations. The result is more sophisticated than anything we know in zoo chimps. A good example are the tool kits, which can be so complex that it is hard to imagine that they were invented in a single step. A typical one was found by the American primatologist Cricket Sands in the Guologo Triangle, Republic of Congo, where a chimpanzee may arrive with two different sticks at a particular open spot in the forest. It is always the same combination. One is a stout, woody sapling of about a meter long, while the other is a flexible, slender herb stem. The chimp then proceeds to deliberately drive the first stick into the ground, working it with both hands and feet the way we do with a shovel. Having made a sizable hole to perforate an army ant nest deep under the surface, she pulls out the stick and smells it, then carefully inserts her second tool. The flexible stem captures bite-happy insects as she pulls up and eats, dipping regularly into the nest below. Apes often climb off the ground, moving onto tree buttresses to avoid the nasty bites of colony defenders. Sands collected more than 1,000 such tools, which shows how common the perforator-dipping combination is. More elaborate toolkits are known for chimpanzees in Gabon hunting for honey. In yet another dangerous activity, these chimps raid bee nests using a 5-piece toolkit, which includes a pounder, a heavy stick to break open the hive's entrance, a perforator, a stick to perforate the ground to get to the honey chamber, an enlarger to enlarge an opening through sideways action, a collector, a stick with a frayed end to dip into honey and slurp it off, and swabs, strips of bark to scoop up honey. This tool use is complicated since the tools are prepared and carried to the hive before most of the work begins, and they will need to be kept nearby until the chimp is forced to quit due to aggressive bees. Their use takes foresight and planning of sequential steps, exactly the sort of organization of activities often emphasized for our human ancestors. At one level, chimpanzee tool use may seem primitive, as it is based on sticks and stones. But on another level, it is extremely advanced. Sticks and stones are all they have in the forest, and we should keep in mind that also for the bushmen, the most ubiquitous instrument is the digging stick, a sharpened stick to break open anthills and dig up roots. The tool use of wild chimpanzees by far exceeds what was ever held possible. Chimpanzees use between 15 and 25 different tools per community, and the precise tools vary with cultural and ecological circumstances. One savanna community, for example, uses pointed sticks to hunt. This came as a shock, since hunting weapons were thought to be another uniquely human advance. The chimpanzees jab their spears into a tree cavity to kill a sleeping bush baby, a small primate that serves as a protein source for female apes unable to run down monkeys the way males do. It is also well known that chimpanzee communities in West Africa crack nuts with stones, a behavior unheard of in East African communities. Human novices have trouble cracking the same tough nuts, partly because they do not have the same muscle strength as an adult chimpanzee, but also because they lack the required coordination. It takes years of practice to place one of the hardest nuts in the world on a level surface, find a good-sized hammer stone, and hit the nut with the right speed while keeping one's fingers out of the way. The Japanese primatologist Tetsuro Matsuzawa tracked the